irrational signification by some voluntary and sufficient sign or signs that he doth so renounce or transfer, or hath so renounced or transferred the same to him that accepteth it. And these signs are either words only or actions only, or, as it happeneth most often, both words and actions. And the same are the bonds by which men are bound and obliged, bonds that have their strength not from their own nature, for nothing is more easily broken than a man's word, but from fear of some evil consequence upon the rupture. Not all rights are alienable. Whensoever a man transferreth his right or renounceth it, it is either in consideration of some right reciprocally transferred to himself, or for some other good he hopeth for thereby. For it is a voluntary act, and of the voluntary acts of every man the object is some good to himself. And therefore there be some rights which no man can be understood by any words or other signs to have abandoned or transferred. As first a man cannot lay down the right of resisting them, that assault him by force to take away his life, because he cannot be understood to aim thereby at any good to himself. The same may be said of wounds and chains and imprisonment, both because there is no benefit consequent to such patience as there is to the patience of suffering another to be wounded or imprisoned, as also because a man cannot tell, when he seeth men proceed against him by violence, whether they intend his death or not. And lastly, the motive and end for which this renouncing and transferring of right is introduced is nothing else but the security of a man's person in his life and in the means of so preserving life as not to be weary of it. And therefore, if a man by words or other signs seem to despoil himself of the end for which those signs were intended, he is not to be understood as if he meant it, or that it was his will, but that he was ignorant of how such words and actions were to be interpreted. Contract what? The mutual transferring of right is that which men call contract. There is difference between transferring of right to the thing and transferring or tradition that is delivery of the thing itself. For the thing may be delivered together with the translation of the right, as in buying and selling with ready money, or exchange of goods or lands, and it may be delivered some time after. Covenant what? Again, one of the contractors may deliver the thing contracted for on his part and leave the other to perform his part at some determinate time after, and in the meantime be trusted. And then the contract on his part is called pact or covenant, or both parts may contract now to perform hereafter, in which cases he that is to perform in time to come being trusted, his performance is called keeping of promise or faith, and the failing of performance, if it be voluntary, violation of faith. Free gift. When the transferring of right is not mutual, but one of the parties transferreth in hope to gain thereby friendship or service from another or from his friends, or in hope to gain the reputation of charity or magnanimity, or to deliver his mind from the pain of compassion, or in hope of reward in heaven, this is not contract, but gift, free gift, grace, which words signify one and the same thing. Signs of contract express, promise. Signs of contract are either express or by inference. Express are words spoken with understanding of what they signify, and such words are either of the time present or past, as, I give, I grant, I have given, I have granted, I will that this be yours, or of the future, as I will give, I will grant, which words of the future are called promise. Signs of contract by inference. Signs by inference are sometimes the consequence of words, sometimes the consequence of silence, sometimes the consequence of actions, sometimes the consequence of forbearing an action, and generally a sign by inference of any contract is whatsoever sufficiently argues the will of the contractor. Free gift passeth by words of the present or past. Words alone, if they be of the time to come and contain a bare promise, are an insufficient sign of a free gift and therefore not obligatory. For if they be of the time to come, as tomorrow I will give, they are a sign I have not given yet, and consequently that my right is not transferred, but remaineth till I transfer it by some other act. But if the words be of the time present or past, as I have given or do give to be delivered tomorrow, then is my tomorrow's right given away today, and that by the virtue of the words, though there were no other argument of my will. And there is a great difference in the signification of these words, volo hoc tuum esse cras, and cras dabo, that is, between I will that this be thine tomorrow, and I will give it thee tomorrow. For the word I will, in the former manner of speech, signifies an act of the will present, but in the latter it signifies a promise of an act of the will to come, and therefore the former words, being of the present, transfer a future right. The latter, that be of the future, transfer nothing. But if there be other signs of the will to transfer a right besides words, then, though the gift be free, yet may the right be understood to pass by words of the future, as if a man propound a prize to him that comes first to the end of a race, the gift is free. And though the words be of the future, yet the right passeth. For if he would not have his words so be understood, he should not have let them run. Signs of contract are words both of the past, present, and future. In contracts the right passeth, not only where the words are of the time present or past, but also where they are of the future, because all contract is mutual translation or change of right, and therefore he that promiseth only because he hath already received the benefit for which he promiseth is to be understood as if he intended the right should pass. For unless he had been content to have his words so understood, the other would not have performed his part first. And for that cause, in buying and selling and other acts of contract, a promise is equivalent to a covenant, and therefore obligatory. Merit what? He that performeth first in the case of a contract is said to merit that which he is to receive by the performance of the other, and he hath it as due. Also, when a prize is propounded to many, which is to be given to him only that winneth, or money is thrown amongst many to be enjoyed by them that catch it, though this be a free gift, yet so to win or so to catch is to merit, and to have it as due. For the right is transferred in the propounding of the prize, and in throwing down the money, though it be not determined to whom, but by the event of the contention. But there is between these two sorts of merit this difference, that in contract I merit by virtue of my own power and the contractor's need. But in this case of free gift, I am enabled to merit only by the benignity of the giver. In contract, I merit at the contractor's hand that he should depart with his right. In this case of gift, I merit not that the giver should part with his right, but that when he has parted with it, it should be mine rather than another's. And this I think to be the meaning of that distinction of the schools between meritum congrui and meritum condini. For God Almighty, having promised paradise to those men hoodwinked with carnal desires that can walk through this world according to the precepts and limits prescribed by him, they say, he that shall so walk shall merit paradise ex congruo. But because no man can demand a right to it by his own righteousness or any other power in himself, but by the free grace of God only, they say, no man can merit paradise ex condino. This, I say, I think, is the meaning of that distinction, but because disputers do not agree upon the signification of their own terms of art longer than it serves their turn, I will not affirm anything of their meaning. Only this, I say, when a gift is given indefinitely as a prize to be contended for, he that winneth meriteth, and may claim the prize as due. Covenants of mutual trust when invalid. If a covenant be made wherein neither of the parties perform presently but trust one another, in the condition of mere nature, which is a condition of war of every man against every man upon any reasonable suspicion, it is void. But if there be a common power set over them both, with right and force sufficient to compel performance, it is not void. For he that performeth first has no assurance the other will perform after, because the bonds of words are too weak to bridle men's ambition, avarice, anger, and other passions, without the fear of some coercive power, which in the condition of mere nature, where all men are equal and judges of the justness of their own fears, cannot possibly be supposed. And therefore he which performeth first does but betray himself to his enemy. Contrary to the right he can never abandon of defending his life and means of living. But in a civil estate, where there is a power set up to constrain those that would otherwise violate their faith, that fear is no more reasonable. And for that cause he which by the covenant is to perform first is obliged so to do. The cause of fear which maketh such a covenant invalid must be always something arising after the covenant made, as some new fact or other sign of the will not to perform, else it cannot make the covenant void. For that which could not hinder a man from promising ought not to be admitted as a hindrance of performing. Right to the end containeth right to the means. He that transferreth any right transferreth the means of enjoying it, as far as lieth in his power, as he that selleth land is understood to transfer the herbage and whatsoever grows upon it, nor can he that sells a mill turn away the stream that drives it. And they that give to a man the right of government in sovereignty are understood to give him the right of levying money to maintain soldiers, and of appointing magistrates for the administration of justice. No covenant with beasts. To make covenants with brute beasts is impossible, because not understanding our speech they understand not, nor accept of any translation of right, nor can translate any right to another, and without mutual acceptation there is no covenant. Nor with God without special revelation. To make covenant with God is impossible, but by mediation of such as God speaketh to, either by revelation supernatural, or by his lieutenants that govern under him and in his name, for otherwise we know not whether our covenants be accepted or not, and therefore they that vow anything contrary to any law of nature vow in vain, as being a thing unjust to pay such vow. And if it be a thing commanded by the law of nature, it is not the vow, but the law that binds them. No covenant, but of possible and future. The matter or subject of a covenant is always something that falleth under deliberation, for to covenant is an act of the will, that is to say, an act and the last act of deliberation, and is therefore always understood to be something to come, and which is judged possible for him that covenanteth to perform. And therefore to promise that which is known to be impossible is no covenant, but if that prove impossible afterwards, which before was thought possible, the covenant is valid and bindeth, though not to the thing itself, yet to the value, or, if that also be impossible, to the unfeigned endeavour of performing as much as is possible, for to more no man can be obliged. Covenants how made void. Men are freed of their covenants two ways, by performing or by being forgiven. For performance is the natural end of obligation, and forgiveness the restitution of liberty, as being a re-transferring of that right in which the obligation consisted. Covenants extorted by fear are valid. Covenants entered into by fear in the condition of mere nature are obligatory. For example, if I covenant to pay a ransom or service for my life to an enemy, I am bound by it, for it is a contract, wherein one receiveth the benefit of life. The other is to receive money or service for it, and consequently where no other law, as in the condition of mere nature, forbiddeth the performance, the covenant is valid. Therefore, prisoners of war, if trusted with the payment of their ransom, are obliged to pay it. And if a weaker prince make a disadvantageous peace with a stronger for fear, he is bound to keep it, unless, as hath been said before, there ariseth some new and just cause of fear to renew the war. And even in commonwealths, if I be forced to redeem myself from a thief by promising him money, I am bound to pay it, till the civil law discharge me. For whatsoever I may lawfully do without obligation, the same I may lawfully covenant to do through fear, and what I lawfully covenant I cannot lawfully break. The former covenant to one makes void the later to another. A former covenant makes void a later, for a man that hath passed away his right to one man today, hath it not to pass tomorrow to another, and therefore the later promise passeth no right but is null. A man's covenant not to defend himself is void. A covenant not to defend myself from force by force is always void, for, as I have showed before, no man can transfer or lay down his right to save himself from death, wounds, and imprisonment, the avoiding whereof is the only end of laying down any right, and therefore the promise of not resisting force in no covenant transferreth any right, nor is obliging. For though a man may covenant thus, unless I do so, or so kill me, he cannot covenant thus, unless I do so, or so, I will not resist you when you come to kill me. For man by nature chooseth the lesser evil, which is danger of death in resisting, rather than the greater, which is certain and present death in not resisting. And this is granted to be true by all men, in that they lead criminals to execution and prison with armed men, notwithstanding that such criminals have consented to the law by which they are condemned. No man obliged to accuse himself. A covenant to accuse oneself without assurance of pardon is likewise invalid, for in the condition of nature where every man is judge, there is no place for accusation, and in the civil state the accusation is followed with punishment, which being force, a man is not obliged not to resist. The same is also true of the accusation of those by whose condemnation a man falls into misery, as of a father, wife, or benefactor. For the testimony of such an accuser, if it be not willingly given, is presumed to be corrupted by nature, and therefore not to be received, and where a man's testimony is not to be credited, he is not bound to give it. Also, accusations upon torture are not to be reputed as testimonies, for torture is to be used as means of conjecture and light in the further examination and search of truth. And what is in that case confessed tendeth to the ease of him that is tortured, not to the informing of the torturers, and therefore ought not to have the credit of a sufficient testimony. For whether he deliver himself by true or false accusation, he does it by the right of preserving his own life. The end of an oath, the form of an oath. The force of words being, as I have formerly noted, too weak to hold men to the performance of their covenants, there are in man's nature but two imaginable helps to strengthen it, and those are either a fear of the consequence of breaking their word, or a glory or pride in appearing not to need to break it. This latter is a generosity too rarely found to be presumed on, especially in the pursuers of wealth, command, or sensual pleasure, which are the greatest part of mankind. The passion to be reckoned upon is fear, whereof there be two very general objects, one the power of spirits invisible, the other the power of those men they shall therein offend. Of these two, though the former be the greater power, yet the fear of the latter is commonly the greater fear. The fear of the former is in every man his own religion, which hath place in the nature of man before civil society. The latter hath not so, at least not place enough, to keep men to their promises, because in the condition of mere nature the inequality of power is not discerned but by the event of battle. so that before the time of civil society or in the interruption thereof by war, there is nothing can strengthen a covenant of peace agreed on against the temptations of avarice, ambition, lust, or other strong desire, but the fear of that invisible power which they every one worship as God, and fear as a revenger of their perfidy. All, therefore, that can be done between two men not subject to civil power is to put one another to swear by the God he feareth, which swearing or oath is a form of speech added to a promise, by which he that promiseth signifieth that unless he perform, he renounceth the mercy of his God, or calleth to him for vengeance on himself. Such was the heathen form. Let Jupiter kill me else as I kill this beast. So is our form. I shall do thus and thus, so help me God. And this with the rites and ceremonies which everyone useth in his own religion, that the fear of breaking faith might be the greater. No oath but by God. By this it appears that an oath taken according to any other form or rite than his that sweareth is in vain, and no oath, and that there is no swearing by anything which the swearer thinks not God. For though men have sometimes used to swear by their kings for fear or flattery, yet they would have it thereby understood they attributed to them divine honour, and that swearing unnecessarily by God is but profaning of his name, and swearing by other things, as men do in common discourse, is not swearing but an impious custom, gotten by too much vehemence of talking. An oath adds nothing to the obligation. It appears also that the oath adds nothing to the obligation, for a covenant, if lawful, binds in the sight of God, without the oath, as much as with it, if unlawful, bindeth not at all, though it be confirmed with an oath. Chapter 15. Of Other Laws of Nature. The third law of nature, justice. From that law of nature by which we are obliged to transfer to another such rights as being retained hinder the peace of mankind, there followeth a third, which is this, that men perform their covenants made, without which covenants are in vain and but empty words, and the right of all men to all things remaining, we are still in the condition of war. Justice and injustice what? And in this law of nature consisteth the fountain and original of justice, for where no covenant hath preceded, there hath no right been transferred, and every man has right to every thing, and consequently no action can be unjust. But when a covenant is made, then to break it is unjust, and the definition of injustice is no other than the not performance of covenant, and whatsoever is not unjust is just. Justice and propriety begin with the constitution of commonwealth. But because covenants of mutual trust, where there is a fear of not performance on either part, as hath been said in the former chapter, are invalid, though the original of justice be the making of covenants, yet in justice actually there can be none, till the cause of such fear be taken away, which while men are in the natural condition of war cannot be done. Therefore, before the names of just and unjust can have place, there must be some coercive power to compel men equally to the performance of their covenants, by the terror of some punishment greater than the benefit they expect by the breach of their covenant, and to make good that propriety which by mutual contract men acquire in recompense of the universal right they abandon. And such power there is none before the erection of a commonwealth. And this is also to be gathered out of the ordinary definition of justice in the schools, for they say that justice is the constant will of giving to every man his own. And therefore, where there is no own, that is no propriety, there is no injustice. And where there is no coercive power erected, that is, where there is no commonwealth, there is no propriety. All men having right to all things, Therefore, where there is no commonwealth, there nothing is unjust, so that the nature of justice consisteth in keeping of valid covenants, but the validity of covenants begins not but with the constitution of a civil power sufficient to compel men to keep them, and then it is also that propriety begins. Justice not contrary to reason. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no such thing as justice, and sometimes also with his tongue, seriously alleging that every man's conservation and contentment being committed to his own care, there could be no reason why every man might not do what he thought conduced thereunto, and therefore also to make or not make, keep or not keep covenants was not against reason when it conduced to one's benefit. He does not therein deny that there be covenants, and that they are sometimes broken, sometimes kept, and that such breach of them may be called injustice, and the observance of them justice. But he questioneth whether injustice, taking away the fear of God, for the same fool hath said in his heart, there is no God, may not sometimes stand with that reason which dictateth to every man his own good, and particularly then when it conduceth to such a benefit as shall put a man in a condition to neglect not only the dispraise and revilings, but also the power of other men. The kingdom of God is gotten by violence, but what if it could be gotten by unjust violence? Were it against reason so to get it, when it is impossible to receive hurt by it? And if it be not against reason, it is not against justice, or else justice is not to be approved for good. From such reasoning as this, successful wickedness hath obtained the name of virtue, and some that in all other things have disallowed the violation of faith, yet have allowed it when it is for the getting of a kingdom. And the heathen that believed that Saturn was deposed by his son Jupiter believed nevertheless the same Jupiter to be the avenger of injustice, somewhat like to a piece of law in Coke's Commentaries on Littleton, where he says, if the right heir of the crown be attainted of treason, yet the crown shall descend to him, and eo instante the attainder be void. From which instances a man will be very prone to infer that when the heir apparent of a kingdom shall kill him that is in possession, though his father, you may call it injustice, or by what other name you will, yet it can never be against reason, seeing all the voluntary actions of men tend to the benefit of themselves, and those actions are most reasonable that conduce most to their ends. This specious reasoning is nevertheless false. For the question is not of promises mutual, where there is no security of performance on either side, as when there is no civil power erected over the parties promising, for such promises are no covenants, but either where one of the parties has performed already, or where there is a power to make him perform, there is the question whether it be against reason, that is, against the benefit of the other to perform or not. And I say it is not against reason, for the manifestation whereof we are to consider, first, that when a man doth a thing, which notwithstanding anything can be foreseen, and reckoned on, tendeth to his own destruction, howsoever some accident which he could not expect, arriving may turn it to his benefit, yet such events do not make it reasonably or wisely done. Secondly, that in a condition of war, wherein every man to every man, for want of a common power to keep them all in awe, is an enemy, there is no man who can hope by his own strength or wit to defend himself from destruction without the help of confederates, where every one expects the same defence by the confederation that any one else does, and therefore he which declares he thinks it reason to deceive those that help him, can, in reason, expect no other means of safety than what can be had from his own single power. He, therefore, that breaketh his covenant, and consequently declareth that he thinks he may with reason do so, cannot be received into any society that unite themselves for peace and defence, but by the error of them that receive him, nor, when he is received, be retained in it without seeing the danger of their error, which errors a man cannot reasonably reckon upon as the means of his security, and therefore if he be left or cast out of society, he perisheth, and if he live in society, it is by the errors of other men which he could not foresee nor reckon upon, and consequently against the reason of his preservation. And so, as all men that contribute not to his destruction forbear him only out of ignorance of what is good for themselves. As for the instance of gaining the secure and perpetual felicity of heaven by any way, it is frivolous, there being but one way imaginable, and that is not breaking but keeping of covenant. And for the other instance of attaining sovereignty by rebellion, it is manifest that though the event follow, yet because it cannot reasonably be expected, but rather the contrary, and because by gaining it so others are taught to gain the same in like manner, the attempt thereof is against reason. Justice, therefore, that is to say, keeping of covenant, is a rule of reason by which we are forbidden to do anything destructive to our life, and consequently a law of nature. There be some that proceed further, and will not have the law of nature to be those rules which conduce to the preservation of man's life on earth, but to the attaining of an eternal felicity after death, to which they think the breach of covenant may conduce, and consequently be just and reasonable. Such are they that think it a work of merit to kill or depose or rebel against the sovereign power constituted over them by their own consent. But because there is no natural knowledge of man's estate after death, much less of the reward that is then to be given to breach of faith, but only a belief grounded upon other men's saying that they know it supernaturally, or that they know those that knew them, that knew others that knew it supernaturally, breach of faith cannot be called a precept of reason or nature. Covenants not discharged by the vice of the person to whom they are made. Others that allow for a law of nature, the keeping of faith, do nevertheless make exception of certain persons, as heretics, and such as use not to perform their covenant to others, and this also is against reason. For if any fault of a man be sufficient to discharge our covenant made, the same ought in reason to have been sufficient to have hindered the making of it. Justice of men and justice of actions what? The names of just and unjust, when they are attributed to men, signify one thing, and when they are attributed to actions, another. When they are attributed to men, they signify conformity or inconformity of manners to reason. But when they are attributed to actions, they signify the conformity or inconformity to reason, not of manners or manner of life, but of particular actions. A just man, therefore, is he that taketh all the care he can, that his actions may be all just, and an unjust man is he that neglecteth it. And such men are more often in our language styled by the names of righteous and unrighteous than just and unjust, though the meaning be the same. Therefore, a righteous man does not lose that title by one or a few unjust actions that proceed from sudden passion or mistake of things or persons, nor does an unrighteous man lose his character for such actions as he does or forbears to do for fear, because his will is not framed by the justice, but by the apparent benefit of what he is to do. That which gives to human actions the relish of justice is a certain nobleness or gallantness of courage, rarely found, by which a man scorns to be beholden for the contentment of his life to fraud or breach of promise. This justice of the manners is that which is meant where justice is called a virtue, and injustice a vice. But the justice of actions denominates men not just but guiltless, and the injustice of the same, which is also called injury, gives them but the name of guilty. Justice of manners and justice of actions. Again, the injustice of manners is the disposition or aptitude to do injury, and is injustice before it proceed to act. and without supposing any individual person injured. But the injustice of an action, that is to say injury, supposeth an individual person injured, namely him to whom the covenant was made, and therefore many times the injury is received by one man when the damage redoundeth to another, as when the master commandeth his servant to give money to a stranger. If it be not done, the injury is done to the master whom he had before covenanted to obey, but the damage redoundeth to the stranger, to whom he had no obligation, and therefore could not injure him. And so also in commonwealths. Private men may remit to one another their debts, but not robberies or other violences whereby they are endamaged, because the detaining of debt is an injury to themselves, but robbery and violence are injuries to the person of the commonwealth. Nothing done to a man by his own consent can be injury. Whatsoever is done to a man, conformable to his own will signified to the doer, is no injury to him. For if he that doeth it hath not passed away his original right to do what he please by some antecedent covenant, there is no breach of covenant, and therefore no injury done him. And if he have, then his will to have it done being signified is a release of that covenant, and so again there is no injury done him. Justice commutative and distributive. Justice of actions is by writers divided into commutative and distributive, and the former, they say, consisteth in proportion arithmetical, the latter in proportion geometrical. Commutative, therefore, they place in the equality of value of the things contracted for, and distributive in the distribution of equal benefit to men of equal merit. As if it were injustice to sell dearer than we buy, or to give more to a man than he merits. The value of all things contracted for is measured by the appetite of the contractors, and therefore the just value is that which they be contented to give. And merit, besides that which is by covenant, where the performance on one part meriteth the performance on the other part, and falls under justice commutative, not distributive, is not due to justice, but is rewarded of grace only. And therefore this distinction, in the sense wherein it useth to be expounded, is not right. To speak properly, commutative justice is the justice of a contractor, that is, a performance of covenant in buying and selling, hiring and letting to hire, lending and borrowing, exchanging, bartering, and other acts of contract. And distributive justice, the justice of an arbitrator, that is to say, the act of defining what is just, wherein, being trusted by them that make him arbitrator, if he perform his trust, he is said to distribute to every man his own. And this is indeed just distribution, and may be called, though improperly, distributive justice, but more properly, equity, which also is a law of nature, as shall be shown in due place. The fourth law of nature, gratitude. As justice dependeth on antecedent covenant, so does gratitude depend on antecedent grace, that is to say, antecedent free gift, and is the fourth law of nature, which may be conceived in this form, that a man which receiveth benefit from another of mere grace, endeavour that he which giveth it have no reasonable cause to repent him of his good will. For no man giveth but with intention of good to himself, because gift is voluntary, and of all voluntary acts the object is to every man his own good, of which if men see they shall be frustrated, there will be no beginning of benevolence or trust, nor consequently of mutual help, nor of reconciliation of one man to another, of war, which is contrary to the first and fundamental law of nature, which commandeth men to seek peace. The breach of this law is called ingratitude, and hath the same relation to grace that injustice hath to obligation by covenant. The fifth mutual accommodation, or complaisance. A fifth law of nature is complaisance, that is to say, that every man strive to accommodate himself to the rest, for the understanding whereof we may consider that there is in men's aptness to society a diversity of nature, rising from their diversity of affections, not unlike to that we see in stones brought together for building of an edifice. For as that stone which by the asperity and irregularity of figure takes more room from others than itself fills, and for the hardness cannot be easily made plain, and thereby hindereth the building, is by the builders cast away as unprofitable and troublesome. So also a man that by asperity of nature will strive to retain those things which to himself are superfluous, and to others necessary. And for the stubbornness of his passions cannot be corrected, is to be left or cast out of society as cumbersome thereunto. For seeing every man, not only by right, but also by necessity of nature, is supposed to endeavour all he can to obtain that which is necessary for his conservation, he that shall oppose himself against it for things superfluous is guilty of the war that thereupon is to follow. And therefore doth that which is contrary to the fundamental law of nature, which commandeth to seek peace. The observers of this law may be called sociable. The Latins call them commodi, the contrary, stubborn, insociable, forward, intractable. The sixth, facility to pardon. A sixth law of nature is this, that upon caution of the future time, a man ought to pardon the offences past of them than repenting desire it. For pardon is nothing but granting of peace, which, though granted to them that persevere in their hostility, be not peace but fear, yet not granted to them that give caution of the future time, is sign of an aversion to peace, and therefore contrary to the law of nature. The seventh, that in revenges men respect only the future good. A seventh is, that in revenges, that is, retribution of evil for evil, men look not at the greatness of the evil past, but the greatness of the good to follow. Whereby we are forbidden to inflict punishment with any other design than for correction of the offender or direction of others. For this law is consequent to the next before it, that commandeth pardon upon security of the future time. Besides, revenge without respect to the example and profit to come is a triumph or glorying in the hurt of another, tending to no end. For the end is always somewhat to come, and glorying to no end is vainglory and contrary to reason, and to hurt without reason tendeth to the introduction of war, which is against the law of nature and is commonly styled by the name of cruelty. The eighth, against contumely. And because all signs of hatred or contempt provoke to fight, insomuch as most men choose rather to hazard their life than not to be revenged, we may in the eighth place for a law of nature set down this precept, that no man by deed, word, countenance, or gesture declare hatred or contempt of another, the breach of which law is commonly called contumely. The ninth, against pride. The question who is the better man has no place in the condition of mere nature, where, as has been shown before, all men are equal. The inequality that now is has been introduced by the laws civil. I know that Aristotle, in the first book of his Politics, for a foundation of his doctrine, maketh men by nature some more worthy to command, meaning the wiser sort, such as he thought himself to be for his philosophy, others to serve, meaning those that had strong bodies, but were not philosophers as he. As if master and servant were not introduced by consent of men, but by difference of wit, which is not only against reason, but also against experience. For there are very few so foolish that had not rather govern themselves than be governed by others, nor when the wise in their own conceit contend by force with them who distrust their own wisdom, do they always or often or almost at any time get the victory. If nature therefore have made men equal, that equality is to be acknowledged. Or if nature have made men unequal, yet because men that think themselves equal will not enter into conditions of peace but upon equal terms, such equality must be admitted. and therefore, for the ninth law of nature, I put this, that every man acknowledge another for his equal by nature. The breach of this precept is pride. The tenth against arrogance. On this law dependeth another, that at the entrance into conditions of peace, no man require to reserve to himself any right which he is not content should be reserved to every one of the rest. As it is necessary for all men that seek peace to lay down certain rights of nature, that is to say, not to have liberty to do all they list, so is it necessary for man's life to retain some, as right to govern their own bodies, enjoy air, water, motion, ways to go from place to place, and all things else, without which a man cannot live or not live well. If in this case, at the making of peace, men require for themselves that which they would not have to be granted to others, they do contrary to the precedent law, that commandeth the acknowledgment of natural equality, and therefore also against the law of nature. The observers of this law are those we call modest, and the breakers arrogant men. The 11th, equity. Also, if a man be trusted to judge between man and man, it is a precept of the law of nature that he deal equally between them. For without that, the controversies of men cannot be determined but by war. He therefore that is partial in judgment doth what in him lies, to deter men from the use of judges and arbitrators, and consequently against the fundamental law of nature, is the cause of war. The observance of this law, from the equal distribution to each man of that which in reason belongeth to him, is called equity, and as I have said before, distributive justice, the violation, exception of persons. The 12th, equal use of things common. And from this followeth another law, that such things as cannot be divided be enjoyed in common, if it can be, and if the equality of the thing permit, without stint, otherwise proportionably to the number of them that have right, for otherwise the distribution is unequal and contrary to equity. The 13th, of lot. But some things there be that can neither be divided nor enjoyed in common. Then the law of nature, which prescribeth equity, requireth that the entire right, or else making the use alternate, the first possession be determined by lot. For equal distribution is of the law of nature, and other means of equal distribution cannot be imagined. The 14th, of primogeniture and first seizing. Of lots there be two sorts, arbitrary and natural. Arbitrary is that which is agreed on by the competitors. Natural is either primogeniture, which signifies given by lot, or first seizure. And therefore those things which cannot be enjoyed in common nor divided ought to be adjudged to the first possessor, and in some cases in the firstborn as acquired by lot. The 15th, of mediators. It is also a law of nature that all men that mediate peace be allowed safe conduct. For the law that commandeth peace as the end commandeth intercession as the means, and to intercession the means is safe conduct. The 16th, of submission to arbitrament. And because, though men be never so willing to observe these laws, there may nevertheless arise questions concerning a man's action. First, whether it were done or not done. Secondly, if done, whether against the law or not against the law. The former whereof is called a question of fact, the latter a question of right. Therefore, unless the parties to the question covenant mutually to stand to the sentence of another, they are as far from peace as ever. This other to whose sentence they submit is called an arbitrator, and therefore it is of the law of nature that they that are at controversy submit their right to the judgment of an arbitrator. The 17th, no man is his own judge. And seeing every man is presumed to do all things in order to his own benefit, no man is a fit arbitrator in his own cause. And if he were never so fit, yet equity allowing to each party equal benefit, if one be admitted to be judged, the other is to be admitted also. And so the controversy that is the cause of war remains against the law of nature. The 18th, no man to be judged that has in him a natural cause of partiality. For the same reason, no man in any cause ought to be received for arbitrator, to whom greater profit or honour or pleasure apparently ariseth out of the victory of one party than of the other. For he hath taken, though an unavoidable bribe, yet a bribe, and no man can be obliged to trust him. And thus also the controversy and the condition of war remaineth, contrary to the law of nature. The 19th of witnesses. And in a controversy of fact, the judge being to give no more credit to one than to the other, if there be no other arguments, must give credit to a third or to a third and fourth or more, for else the question is undecided and left to force, contrary to the law of nature. These are the laws of nature, dictating peace for a means of the conservation of men in multitudes, and which only concern the doctrine of civil society. There be other things tending to the destruction of particular men, as drunkenness and all other parts of intemperance, which may therefore also be reckoned amongst those things which the law of nature hath forbidden, but are not necessary to be mentioned, nor are pertinent enough to this place. A rule by which the laws of nature may easily be examined. And though this may seem too subtle a deduction of the laws of nature to be taken notice of by all men, whereof the most part are too busy in getting food and the rest too negligent to understand, yet to leave all men inexcusable, they have been contracted into one easy sum, intelligible even to the meanest capacity, and that is, do not that to another which thou wouldst not have done to thyself. Which showeth him that had he no more to do in learning the laws of nature, but when weighing the actions of other men with his own, they seemed too heavy, to put them into the other part of the balance, and his own into their place, that his own passions and self-love may add nothing to the weight. And then there is none of these laws of nature that will not appear unto him very reasonable. The laws of nature oblige in conscience always, but in effect then only when there is security. The laws of nature oblige in foro interno, that is to say, they bind to a desire they should take place, but in foro externo, this is to the putting them in act, not always. For he that should be modest and tractable and perform all he promises in such time and place where no man else should do so, should but make himself a prey to others, and procure his own certain ruin, contrary to the ground of all laws of nature which tend to nature's preservation. And again, he that having sufficient security that others shall observe the same laws towards him, observes them not himself, seeketh not peace but war, and consequently the destruction of his nature by violence. And whatsoever laws bind in foro interno may be broken not only by a fact contrary to the law, but also by a fact according to it, in case a man think it contrary. For though his action in this case be according to the law, yet his purpose was against the law, which, where the obligation is in foro interno, is a breach. The laws of nature are eternal. The laws of nature are immutable and eternal, for injustice, ingratitude, arrogance, pride, iniquity, exception of persons and the rest can never be made lawful. For it can never be that war shall preserve life and peace destroy it. And yet easy. The same laws, because they oblige only to a desire and endeavour, I mean an unfeigned and constant endeavour, are easy to be observed. For in that they require nothing but endeavour, he that endeavoureth their performance fulfilleth them, and he that fulfilleth the law is just. The science of these laws is the true moral philosophy, and the science of them is the true and only moral philosophy. For moral philosophy is nothing else but the science of what is good and evil in the conversation and society of mankind. Good and evil are names that signify our appetites and aversions, which in different tempers, customs, and doctrines of men are different, and divers men differ not only in their judgment on the senses of what is pleasant and unpleasant to the taste, smell, hearing, touch, and sight, but also of what is conformable or disagreeable to reason in the actions of common life. Nay, the same man in divers times differs from himself, and one time praiseth, that is, calleth good what another time he dispraiseth and calleth evil, from whence arise disputes, controversies, and at last war. And therefore, so long as a man is in the condition of mere nature, which is a condition of war, as private appetite is the measure of good and evil, and consequently all men agree on this, that peace is good, and therefore also the way or means of peace, which, as I have showed before, are justice, gratitude, modesty, equity, mercy, and the rest of the laws of nature, are good, that is to say, moral virtues, and their contrary vices, evil. Now the science of virtue and vice is moral philosophy, and therefore the true doctrine of the laws of nature is the true moral philosophy. But the writers of moral philosophy, though they acknowledge the same virtues and vices, yet not seeing wherein consisted their goodness, nor that they come to be praised as the means of peaceable, sociable, and comfortable living, place them in a mediocrity of passions, as if not the cause but the degree of daring made fortitude, or not the cause but the quantity of a gift made liberality. These dictates of reason men used to call by the names of laws, but improperly, for they are but conclusions or theorems concerning what conduceth to the conservation and defence of themselves, whereas law, properly, is the word of him that by right hath command over others. But yet, if we consider the same theorems as delivered in the word of God, that by right commandeth all things, then are they properly called laws. Chapter 16. Of Persons, Authors, and Things Personated. A person what? A person is he whose words or actions are considered either as his own or as representing the words or actions of another man or of any other thing to whom they are attributed, whether truly or by fiction. Person natural and artificial. When they are considered as his own, then is he called a natural person, and when they are considered as representing the words and actions of another, then is he a feigned or artificial person. The word person whence? The word person is Latin, which signifies the face, as persona in Latin signifies the disguise or outward appearance of a man counterfeited on the stage, and sometimes more particularly that part of it which disguiseth the face as a mask or vizard. And from the stage hath been translated to any representer of speech and action, as well in tribunals as theatres. So that a person is the same that an actor is, both on the stage and in common conversation, and to personate is to act or represent himself or another, and he that acteth another is said to bear his person or act in his name, in which sense Cicero useth it where he says, Unus sustenio tres personas, me adversari et judicis. I bear three persons, my own, my adversaries, and the judges, and is called in diverse occasions diversely as a representer or representative, a lieutenant, a vicar, an attorney, a deputy, a procurator, an actor, and the like. Actor, author, authority. Of persons artificial, some have their words and actions owned by those whom they represent, and then the person is the actor, and he that owneth his words and actions is the author, in which case the actor acteth by authority. For that which, in speaking of goods and possessions, is called an owner, and in Latin dominus, is called author. And as the right of possession is called dominion, so the right of doing any action is called authority. So that by authority is always understood a right of doing any act, and done by authority, done by commission or license, from him whose right it is. Covenants by authority bind the author. From hence it followeth that when the actor maketh a covenant by authority, he bindeth thereby the author, no less than if he had made it himself, and no less subjecteth him to all the consequences of the same. And therefore all that hath been said formerly, chapter 14, of the nature